We were waiting for some stuff from some of the bills on the first page, so we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1089. Let's start. Mr. Putman.
Mr. Chairman, this bill increases the annual fee on dry cleaning facilities, requires them to have and post a certificate indicating that they've paid that fee. The reason for this is that the fees are supposed to provide sufficient funds for cleanup of various solvents used in the dry cleaning business. The amount that is being collected now is insufficient to do the job, and the fees are being raised with the expectation that they'll bring in sufficient amounts. One of the changes is that the establishments that used to do less than $50,000 a year business were exempt from the fees. They're no longer exempt.
Okay, we have no one who signed up to testify in this bill. Mr. Putman, did anybody talk to you about the bill?
I assumed the EQ was going to be here, but no, no one has contacted me. Oh, here's somebody.
We might want to testify after all. The bill's been put back on life support. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Dixie Dale, who works on the program that we're talking about today. And I think Mr. Martin will thank me big time for fucking up and maybe keeping his bill alive. It is not a Department of Environmental Quality bill. We were involved with the discussions in shaping it. Actually, we are cautiously supportive of this bill, and during the negotiations on the bill recommended a different path than this bill is going. But that being said, we are cautiously supportive of the bill. Just very briefly, in 1995, the Oregon legislature established what is essentially, we call it an insurance pool to pay to clean up contaminated sites caused by dry cleaning establishments. And it was a two-part law, actually, and it was brought forward by the dry cleaning industry. One part dealt with the prevention of future contamination from dry cleaning activities, and the second dealt with cleaning up existing contamination. And there's a trade-off involved. The dry cleaners agreed or desired, it was their idea to establish this insurance pool to clean up contaminated sites, and in return, they would be released from state liability for that cleanup. In other words, we wouldn't go after them to pay for the cleanups, the cleanups would be paid for out of this insurance pool. It was an innovative idea in 1995, and we still look at it as a pilot, still, you know, watching it evolve. We've implemented it quite well, but the problem with it and the reason why the bill's before you today is because the agreed upon fees that the dry cleaners put together to create this insurance pool is not bringing in the money that it needs to. So what we have here is a bill that the dry cleaning industry has brought forward to better bring in the revenue needed to pay for the cleanups that need to occur at dry cleaning sites.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Maybe, Mr. Chair, I happened to be here in 1995 when this came through my committee. And I remember at the time, one of the reasons, one of the positive aspects of putting this through was the fact, not just for the cleanup, but the exempt of the small ones. There was a lot of testimony that the people didn't want to do this, the small ones. And I don't know if the question is, since Mr. Martin's not here, is this is an industry's position now that it's fine to put the fee on everybody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, The fee, I think, has always been on everyone. What this bill does is actually changes the fees paid by what is called dry stores. And dry stores are dry cleaning establishments that collect the clothes to be dry cleaned, but they take it somewhere else for dry cleaning. And in the past, that was exempted, and this bill now includes those in the base annual fee.
I use the wrong terminology, but I know there was a there was significant discussion over who's going to pay and who wasn't going to pay in that process.
And this bill, as I said, is not really ours. We were present during the discussions, but this is a bill that the dry cleaning industry has agreed upon, and there's various factions in the dry cleaning industry, and they have agreed upon this bill, I believe, which is before you say.
Thank you very much. I know my discussions with Senator Nelson, who has been working on this bill for most of the session, I think, the industry had worked together and, you know, been through a lot of battles, and this is what we came up with, they could all support. Obviously, it must not be too contentious now, or someone would be here to talk about it. Was it more set?
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. The buy-in is $2,500 for a new establishment, I see. What's the, and I'm looking for the ongoing fee.
The, Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, there's an annual fee of $1,000 for a dry cleaning establishment. And then there's a fee on the use of the chemicals involved in dry cleaning, perchloroethylene and other solvents. There's a fee on each gallon used, and together they make up the pot that is used to pay to clean up the site.
So, can I follow up? What would an average cleaning establishment pay per year under the existing fee?
They pay the, Mr. Chair, Morissette, they pay the $1,000 per year annual fee, and then depending on how much perchloroethylene they use, some may use 20 gallons, some may use 50 gallons, they pay another, and the fee is now, I believe, $13. It's going to go to $17 on the gallon. So this amounts to, a couple, $3,000.
Okay. May I ask another question? We have a dry cleaning establishment in Springfield that actually has several places in Roseburg, and they don't use chemicals. It's a water-based cleaning establishment. Do they have to pay this fee?
Mr. Chair, I'll turn to Dick DeSale for that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette.
We need to name the record.
Oh, my name is Richard DeSale. I also work with DEQ in the dry cleaner program. If a business wet cleans only, we don't consider them a dry cleaner, so they don't pay the fees in the program.
Thank you. Martin, do you have any testimonies that you have on this bill before we go into work session?
We'll close the public hearing. Open the discussion on Senate Bill 1089.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 1089 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 1089 to the House floor to due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Snow.
I'll provide you with a courtesy vote and talk with Mr. Martin after the
Okay.
After the committee.
Would you like him to testify in front of this? Okay. Hold the roll, please.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Mills?
Aye.
Representative Lunsford?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Member for the required number of votes. Senate Bill 1089 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteers? Susan Lunsford, you're probably most familiar with this. You had it 95.
I don't have any canopy on carrying it.
We will close the work session. We'll now go to next.
We have the amendment 1021.
Okay. Get that amendment.
907. Senate Bill 907. Open a session. Mr. Fox. Mr. Fuller, was in the room earlier, he indicated to me that they are not going to offer any amendments.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, you heard this bill then on Monday, and I believe it was your intent to hold it for possible amendments today, and if there aren't any, it's your call.
That's what the sponsor of the bill told me, that they don't need any amendments after all, so. Then Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 907A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Then Gardner moves Senate Bill 907 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knopf?
Aye.
Representative Unquist?
Aye.
Representative Marset?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair
Byer? Aye. I received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 907 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. On Monday, I have Representative Gardner, Representative Knope, and Representative Thompson. They're all co-sponsors. Did you decide who wants to carry the bill?
Okay.
Representative Knope will carry.
I'm glad you're in this.
We'll now go to Senate Bill 1088 and open the work session on Senate Bill 1088. Are you ready?
Okay, Mr. Chairman. This is simple, if not straightforward.
How many amendments do we have?
Two.
Okay.
I sent you the conflict amendment. No, excuse me, there are no conflict amendments. I sent you the A4 amendments, and the A4 on line 12. Leave out the words on page 9. It was just a drafting error in LC, and I have a A5, which is identical to the A4 I sent you, except that it tells what line they're amending. These are the amendments that we talked about very briefly on Monday that clean up various, well, it didn't clean up. It tweaks, clarifies the language on various pieces of the bill, plus a couple of substantive amendments have to do with the fact that the owner of the property on which one of these homes is located, that is to say the facilities, isn't always in control about whether or not the electricity is flowing to his property or the water main is broken, and so it makes it clear that he's responsible for providing those services to the extent over which he has control. Mr. Van Landingham is here with an extensive write-up, which I'll be glad to hand out to the committee, and he's prepared to speak to as much or as little of it as the committee sees fit.
Okay, and you have the write-up here, along with the amendments?
He has the write-up.
Okay, Mr. Van Landingham, would you come up and officially put that on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. John Van Landingham, Lane County Law and Advocacy. What I'm distributing is what I promised on Monday, and that is a 21-page explanation of the bill in non-statutory language. And it's something we've done, the coalition has done historically with landlord-tenant bills, is to explain what we think we were doing and why we did it and what it does. I gave a copy to Representative Morissette office yesterday, since he asked for it early, and I gave it to Keith yesterday as well. I didn't have it ready on Monday. I've also given you a corrected who gets what list for this bill, correct some errors that I made, some things that I left off. And there's a who gets what list for 3098, which is the general landlord-tenant bill, which came out of this committee earlier. So, again, these documents simply explain what are in the bill. The amendments, as Keith said, are some corrections and also some last-minute changes and negotiations that went on within the coalition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any members, we also have at least one other document. Did you hand those out? Do we have those? The statement from Doug Riggs in opposition to the bill.
Pass those out.
Please pass those out. Another person who has given us testimony in opposition to the bill. So that also for your file. Are there any questions about the bill before we get move the amendments?
Does the 85 correct all the conflicts?
It's my understanding. I got these just yesterday's, like quarter after five. It's my understanding that it, either it or 3098 have been adjusted so that where there are similar sections of the statute, they use the same words. That's the intent.
So there's no conflict between the two intents?
To my best of belief, I'm still required to double-check that before I drop it, and you'd all keep your fingers crossed or whatever you do, you'll let it, it should go.
Rabbit's foot or whatever.
Well, I would assume legislative council has made those checks in their proofreading.
Yeah.
No, nope.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5 amendment to Senate Bill 1088.
Representative Snope, move the A5 amendment to the Senate Bill 1088. Discussion on the motion. Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Snope.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 1088 as amended to the floor to be passed.
Representative Snope moves Senate Bill 1088 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? None. Call the roll.
Representative
Knoll? Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative
Marsak?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 1088 as amended moves forward to due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. Close the work session. Please just page two of our agenda, right? Okay. We will now back to, let's do 1021. Open up a public hearing on 1021. Is there anyone who likes testifying the bill? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing for the work session of 1021. President Thompson, did you have some amendments for us? Or?
Yes, I brought some amendments, I believe.
Okay.
And I haven't seen him myself yet, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at the hearing on Monday, Representative Thompson indicated that there should be some prior notice of intent of the operators to enter upon private land. You discussed briefly the durational time limit. I see that these amendments merely require written notice by first class mail.
Representative Morissette.
Before or after they go on the land?
Before.
Also, it doesn't say that.
I
think there should be a 24-hour.
Just prior.
Well, I was being somewhat confused, but I think it should have a 24-hour prior notice for clarity. Because this could come the morning, this could come simultaneously. I mean, this is, I don't know if it makes a big difference, but I think there should be some time limit prior to entering the land, 24-hour.
Chair, that says it's by first class mail. Even 24 hours prior is not a guarantee that they get it in the mail.
Yeah. It's not a big deal.
Could I ask Jerry,
sure,
who worked on this, to come up and...
We started out with 10 days.
Good little idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We had some concerns because we were working on the other side on some legislation which is in a little bit of difficulty reeling notice by agencies to enter private property. We thought it was only fair that private entities do the same. The issue here is that this is only for the original easement. It was a little confusing last time. Now, once the easement's established, people have the right to go on those easements at any reasonable time. So to repair the facility or fix a leak, that isn't a problem. This is only covering the original surveying for the actual easement to establish a class private lands. Representative Morissette had a very good point about, well, what's a reasonable time. I'm comfortable enough that at least we put the focus up saying, please provide notice. I mean, you're right. There should be a reasonable time. I think when I put a day in there, I said 3 days to the LC, but I mean, it's not a big issue. If it's a problem, we can come back and fix it. I think just it's a heads up and letting everybody know what we're doing, and so all sides know how to play in this game. So good bill now. I think at least we've addressed the concerns. Thank you very much.
Thompson, would you like to take action on the bill?
Yes. I would like to just move the dash one amendments to 1021.
President Thompson moves the dash one amendments in the Senate Bill 1021. Discussion on the motion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. President Thompson.
I'd like to move 1021 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Thompson moves the Senate Bill 1021 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion on the motion? Call the roll.
Representative Blanchard?
Aye.
Representative Marquez?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Snow?
Yes.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 1021 moves the House floor as amended. Representative Thompson, you'd like to carry the bill?
Sure.
Okay. That's up to 1088. Okay, we need to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 1088.
Mr. Chairman, with all my paper shuffling here, I missed the fact that, as we discussed Monday, the fee per person per year on residents of mobile home parks is being raised $3 from 3 to 6. That puts a 400 and some odd thousand dollar fiscal impact on it, which I think I heard in your packet. Because of that, the bill should go to Ways and Means, and you might wish to reconsider your due pass and then with referral to Ways and Means. It does not have a subsequent referral on it at this point.
The chair would entertain a motion to
suspend the rules.
Suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 1088. Representative Gardner makes the motion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Now have entertained a motion to reconsider the vote by which we passed.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed our Senate Bill 1088.
Representative Gardner moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 1088. Is there discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? None so ordered. We will now have the bill back in front of us, the amended bill back in front of us. We needed a motion to move the bill to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
President Gardner moves Senate Bill 1088 to the Committee on Ways and Means. They do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative
Snow? He's not here. Excuse.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Chair Byron?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 1088 moves to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
I'm sure you just want to get out of here.
Actually, I wanted to carry the bill. No, I
can't. About you're that.
Thanks. Okay, let's go to if we go there, open a public hearing on.
If you do that, I don't have my guy. I'll see here.
Okay, then let's go to 980. We'll go to Senate Bill 980. Open a public hearing on that bill. And we can get Mr. Pupp.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. 980 has conflict amendments on it. Just wanting to look here. We haven't had a hearing on this yet.
No, we have not.
Okay. What this does is extends the ability of a BOLI to, I guess it's license, additional labor contractors. Right now, limited liability partnerships and limited liability corporations cannot, companies, cannot be labor contractors. This allows additional folks to do that. It requires a bond. Now, there are conflict amendments, and Senate Bill 179 deals with what happens to the fees. This bill, 980, has fees in it, and therefore these fees will go the same place that Senate Bill 179 says fees go to. It's a straight, picks up the code so it matches everywhere, non-substantive change, in my opinion. Did I send out the conflict amendments?
Yes, you have that's the dash A5.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Be in the packet.
And the labor commissioner has been advised of this conflict. And
Jack Roberts and John McCulley, come tell us about it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. This bill is the result of a work group that was set up during the interim and the early portion of this session to try to make sure that our requirements of contracting statutes were consistent with the different forms of organizations that are, in fact, operating in the state and wish to operate in the state. It came up originally because of the Rogue Institute, which was a nonprofit associated with Rogue Valley Community College that was doing training that involved some activities that were regulated under this. And it turned out that our statute didn't seem to allow them to be licensed. And so when we looked at that and how we could make sure they were covered, others came up, including some private businesses that were publicly traded, including professional associations and other groups. And so we thought this would be a good opportunity to clean up our statute. Although, Mr. Fleming said, technically there are fees involved in this. It's just the same fees that are already applied to current farm labor contractors. It just adds it to additional groups. And this was worked out through representatives of growers and other associations, as well as farm worker advocates. And as far as we know, this is a bill that is non-controversial and is really, I think, a house meeting for us to make sure that our laws regulating this comply with the changing structure of the businesses and operations that are engaged in this activity or want to be engaged in this activity.
Questions to the commissioner? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm John McCulley representing tree fruit growers. Those are the growers in the Hood River, Jackson County, Wasco County, and Umatilla County areas. We, too, support Senate Bill 980, and it is a pleasure to come before you today on a farm labor bill on which everybody agrees, and that should say a lot in itself. We were particularly interested in the part of the bill related to allowing associations to become licensed farm labor contractors. Historically, the fruit industry has not used farm labor contractors, but as we are facing more and more difficulties in finding a legal workforce, it has become necessary to look at that option, and by allowing grower associations the option to be licensed as farm labor contractors, we believe that may provide some assistance in reaching that goal of having a legal workforce working in agriculture. So we support Senate Bill 980 and encourage you to do so also.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 980? Okay, no one. We'll close the public hearing and one more session. Senate Bill 980.
Mr. Chair, interrupt. I agree Senate Bill 980 to the floor. Would you have a recommendation?
Representative Gardner, would like to move the dash A5
amendment. I'm sorry.
If you're right.
Conflict amendment. I move the dash A5 amendment.
Representative Gardner moves the dash A5 amendment to Senate Bill 980. Discussion on the motion. Objections. Seems unordered, Mr. Gardner.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 988 as amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, move Senate Bill 980 as amended to the floor of the House for the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Knoll? Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Marquette?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 980 moves the floor as amended to due pass recommendation.
Is Mr. Knoll excused?
Yes. Excuse, let's carry it. Representative Marquette, would you carry the bill? Representative Marquette, would you carry the bill? Okay.
What kind of interest rate?
You need to call.
He's gonna get here as soon as he can. Back from the dentist. He should be through at the dentist, but not in, but he could be in tomorrow night.
Okay, we'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill 285.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is for the purpose of having certain viatical settlement contracts regulated under the security provisions of Oregon law. In 1997, I believe the legislature authorized the sale of these documents. What they are, in short...
95.
Excuse me. What did I say?
95, we authorized it. We just changed it to 97.
Oh, that's correct. Stand corrected. Anyway, a viatical settlement is a person owns a life insurance policy and basically sells it to someone else for a fee. That other person then is the beneficiary of the life insurance policy and is the owner and pays the premium on behalf of the former owner. This bill deals with the idea that that sales agreement, or whatever you want to call it, is sold to some third person under a variety of conditions. And the question then is whether that has become a security that ought to be regulated under securities, or whether it started out as life insurance, it continues to be life insurance, and should remain regulated by the insurance division.
Thank you. We have Jim Harlan, and you have someone with you?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman. How do you pronounce your name?
Josh.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Harlan. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Division of Finance and Corporate Security. Our division regulates most financial products with the exception of insurance. And as part of a larger Department of Consumer and Business Services, which also includes the insurance division. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 285. And along with me, I've invited Bonnie Kaczynski, who would also like to testify with the chair's indulgence. I think the committee administrator framed the issues well. Senate Bill 285, the primary purpose of Senate Bill 285 is to, in effect, close a circle of it. In 1997, the legislature passed legislation which regulated the so-called front end of a viatical transaction, which is the sale of a life insurance policy through a broker to a viatical settlement provider. Senate Bill 285 would close that circle by regulating the transaction from the viatical settlement provider, which is usually a company, to a an investor. Those viatical settlement agreements are marketed in a wide variety of ways, participations, poolings, and carry in our opinion, all the attributes of a fairly conventional security. The issue before the committee is, do we regulate under our securities law or do we regulate under the insurance code? We have met with the opponents of Senate Bill 285, and the issue is not whether they should be regulated. Everyone agrees there's a crying need for regulation. This is an area that is particularly rampant with fraud and misleading statements, as you'll hear in a moment. But again, the issue is whether we need to regulate it under our securities section that deals with the suitability, investor suitability, that deals with investment disclosure, that deals with securities fraud. And with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there are specific questions at this point for me, I have provided my written testimony, a section-by-section analysis, and various supporting documents. I would like to introduce a consumer of biatical settlement agreement.
Gardner, just wanted to ask, how do other states deal with biatical settlement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, there are approximately right now 27 or 28 states that regulate the so-called front end of biatical settlement agreements. There are currently, to my knowledge, five states, North and South Dakota, Iowa, Maine, proposed obviously in Oregon, and I do know directly that the state of Florida also regulates viaticals under their securities law. Interestingly enough, the state of Florida recently took a step to also regulate under their insurance code. So Florida is somewhat unique in the fact that they have a dual regulatory oversight of the entire transaction, as I understand it.
Well, this might be for the, but I'm not sure, but it's in here it talks about the settlements, sales in the U.S. are $1 billion and $20 million in Oregon. Is there a time frame on that? Is that 3 years? Is that since it started or what?
I think that's in recent history, but I'm not sure. I think Mr. Harlan can.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lundquist, my understanding is that that would be over the past several years.
So basically since it started, since the inception.
Since the inception of this type of specific type of activity, yes.
Approximately 3.5 years, I would assume.
So
my question is going to be, you know the number of policies and biological settlements that are sold, but you obviously don't have a number. You have a dollar figure, but in Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have a solid number on that. We're currently investigating several cases. There was a rather large case dealing with several hundred million that originated in the state of California, where an enterprising entrepreneur managed to separate about $500 million, $3 million of which came out of the state of Oregon. And unfortunately, he was so busy raising that kind of capital that he apparently didn't have time to buy any biatical settlement agreements. And most of that money is gone. But it's those kind of figures. We do not have the specific number at this point of how many interesting biatical settlement agreements have been sold to Oregonians.
When you say that he was busy raising the capital, so he was not actually defrauding insurance policyholders, he was defrauding investors.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Go ahead.
My name is Bonnie Kaszewski. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And in 97, I received a phone call at home, and this gentleman said he had a insurance policy through my husband's union where he worked that he'd like to deliver to our house. I want him to come when my husband was home, and he did. I was at a time, and he came over. And at that point, he says, if you have any extra money laying around, I have a really wonderful investment. It's so sure and positive, and there's no, you wouldn't have to worry about a thing. And when he threw out the figure of 28% in 2 years that I would make off this initial investment, I thought it might sounded very good. It should have sounded too good to be true, I guess. But he then, all he could say was how good it was and how sure it was. And so we made arrangements to pull some money out of my IRAs, and which just wasn't a whole lot compared to the figures we're talking about, but it's more than we could afford to lose. And we let him invest this, and he told us that it would definitely, he would be paid off at 28%, 18% on one of them, which would have seemed to run 18 months, and the other would be 28% on the 24 months. And we did this. We invested it. And since then, I could get nothing out of these people. I gave up this Jim Georgian, who was with Capital Investment, or Capital, I don't know what, Liberty Capital. I gave up talking to him, because all I ever got with him was, I'll check and I'll get back to you. And he's never, ever gotten back to me on a thing. One time he did, he got back to me, he said he talked to them in Denver and that they were checking on it. That's as far as he ever got. So I quit talking to him, started calling Denver myself. And I got the same real runaround there. I'm still out my money. I asked him if I could just have, you know, forget the interest. Just give me my original investment back. And they said, no, you can't do that. So I told this Georgian, I had told him I want my original investment back. And he said, no, you can't do that. Well, that got me pretty worried. And I have really been on the phone calling and getting nowhere. And if he hadn't, he told us up front that these people were terminally ill, but it wasn't a case of them having to die before we were paid. It was a case that we would just automatically be paid when the 18-month up was up and the 24-month was up. And to this point, I haven't seen anything, and it doesn't look like I'm going to, from the way they sound. I'm talking to them. So I think it isn't a great amount of money, but it's $20,000 is more than I can afford to lose. I think that's about all I can tell you about him, unless there would be a question.
No questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to briefly follow on Bonnie's testimony. She is involved in a situation which we're currently looking into. The specific policy that she bought a participating interest in. Our subpoenaed records on that indicate that when the policy was originally issued, the insured indicated on the application that he had not tested positive for HIV or AIDS. 6 months later, Liberty acquires that policy and immediately puts out an offer sheet indicating that the insured has suffered from AIDS for approximately 4 years. Now, somewhere in that equation, there is fraud. In addition, the product that Bonnie and her husband invested in is a tranche or a segment of an interest in a life insurance policy as the underlying asset. She is buying, supposedly buying in for a set period of time during which the insurance policy can be contested by the insurance company, normally a 2-year period. After that time, Bonnie supposedly gets out because that's the high risk period. So again, it originates as an insurance policy, but by the time the Viatical Settlement Company gets a hold of it, it bears little resemblance to an insurance policy. And indeed, I have distributed to the committee a letter from the American Council of Life Insurance to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is working on some model rules dealing with viatical settlement contracts, in which the insurance industry itself indicates that they do not consider viatical settlement contracts to be insurance by any stretch of the imagination. And with that, unless there are further questions,
thank you, Mr. Bonnie, what was the time period? How long has it been since?
It was in 97, in June of 97, or July of 97.
So you're, may I continue your...
The one was, the other one was an 18-month, which would have been in February, I believe, of 99.
Okay, so the time is up on both of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If the insurance industry is working on a uniform proposal or a national model, why this bill now as opposed to waiting for that model to be finished? Is it going to be finished soon, and is that going to change what we may do in this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knupp, the NAIC is working on a model. They had a model originally that covered, again, the front side of the transaction, and that, at least in part, is the genesis of 97 legislation. They are now working on a draft. I don't know whether they're in their second or third round draft of what they call a wraparound, because they have recognized the need for regulatory oversight of the part of the transaction that we're talking about. I do not know at this point when they anticipate completion of that model. It may be towards the end of this calendar year. It may be in to next year. The correspondence that I've seen and the comments from the various participants in this process would suggest that they are a ways off. The literature seems to be suggesting need for significant revisions to it. We don't know at this point. And of course, because it's a work in progress, we don't know what the end result would be in terms of providing the kind of adequate coverage. But as the representatives of the insurance agency that regulate insurance products are prepared to testify, they are not in a position to have the kind of expertise on staff to properly assess investment products. That's not what they're there for. They're there to regulate insurance products.
Good question. Well, it seems as though there's a disagreement about what these really are. You said 5 states regulate them as securities, 28 states regulate them as insurance.
apparently states who currently regulate can't figure out what they are. So I'm a little bit concerned at this point.
Well, may I clarify something? I indicated to you that approximately 28 states currently regulate the front side.
Okay.
The transaction from the insurer to the broker, to the company, the viatical settlement company. Those 28 states, as my understanding, if there is regulation of the backside, it would be carried under the current securities laws in those states, as Florida does. The five states have gone further and specifically included viatical settlement agreements in their definition of security to clear up any kind of ambiguity. So I'm not saying 28 states regulate the backside of that transaction.
Mr. Chair, I guess my understanding was different than that. I would appreciate something in writing so we really know what other states are doing with this and how they're regulating them. And it seems like this is something that may need some study. And so I would like to get more information on this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knute, we'd be happy to provide that written.
Thank you.
In one of the, I think, you hand this out too.
No, I would say
that. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Okay. And here it says Oregon sister state. The provisions of the bill are uniform with provisions that have been enacted by Oregon sister states. Regulate this written industry. What is meant by the sister states?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume that the author of the letter is referring to those states that I listed, the North and South Dakota, Iowa, and Maine to this point.
So currently we have four states that regulate them as securities.
Well, we have five that Florida has indicated us in recent days that because there was suspicion raised whether this recent legislation in Florida that regulates viatical settlement agreements under the insurance code, what that did to the status of regulation of the securities law. Our information from the regulators in Florida is that they regulate it now under both laws, insurance law and securities. So Florida has indicated that they're regulating it under their securities law.
So the other 45 states aren't regulating at all if they have viatical settlements?
Well, my understanding, again, from informal conversations with counterparts is that they, to the extent that those problems are arising there, are attempting to take them on under the securities law.
Okay. Any other questions?
This did pass the Senate without opposition, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, that's correct.
And it is a pre-filed. In other words, this has been filed for the session, and it's part of the Department of Consumer Business Service. It's their bill, the governor's.
Yes, that's correct. It is our bill.
Yeah. I would hope that we don't delay on this. Is this our last meeting today?
To the best of my knowledge, this is our last meeting.
Well, I don't have a problem with this. I think it is important that we get something at this point, something.
It has. Mr. Chairman, I assume we're going to hear from the insurance industry.
Yes, we're about to.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Greenfield, do you have any additional testimony you'd like to give?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. My name is Mike Greenfield. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think the underlying policy issue for the committee revolves around protecting the public, and it also revolves around a level playing field. I'm certain that companies in this business who don't cut corners are not interested in competing with companies who do cut corners, and I think that's an important part of the regulatory scheme. If you're in agreement on those policy priorities, then the remaining question is what mechanism will you use? And I think Jim did a pretty good job, but I just want to emphasize, in our toolbox, the people who we have who understand how to do this regulation in a way that achieves both of those policy ends, protecting the consumers and ensuring a level playing field so that people who do this business are competing on a level playing field, reside in our financial end of our business.
Very much.
Thank you.
Brian Bow and Doug Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bow, and I'm appearing here this morning representing the Viatical Association of America. Joining me is Doug Head, who is the president of VAA, has traveled here to be with us today to talk about Senate Bill 285. About to be distributed to the committee is some information and background information about life settlement products and also a copy of the Dash 2 amendments, which we are here to advocate today. To begin with, before I introduce Mr. Head, I would just like to emphasize to the committee that Mr. Putman was correct as he framed the issue. It's not a question about if the product should be regulated, but a question about how will the product be regulated. And the concerns that the industry have that the regulation that they are subject to is thorough, complete, comprehensive, and importantly, consistent from one state to another, as this is a national product and needs to be regulated in a consistent way because of the way that the product crosses state lines. That's why we believe that it is important that the committee consider the Dash 2 amendments that are before you. It is, as the gentleman from the Securities Division noted, the first draft of an NAIC model regarding regulating these products and the sale and distribution of these products. With that introduction, I would like to introduce Mr. Head, who has worked on this legislation around the country and in particular has worked in the situation in Florida, which is one of the states with the highest amount of activity in viatical settlements, and he can address that and other issues related to the bill.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here to speak to you today. I had a long flight, so I may on occasion erroneously refer to your state as Oregon. I know it's Oregon.
Very good. You need to state your name for the record.
My name is Doug Head, and I am the president of the Viatical Association of America, the nation's largest trade group dealing with viatical settlements. The company I actually work for, as well as serving as president of the industry association, is a viatical settlement broker in the traditional term of viatical settlement brokers, which is someone representing a viator seeking to sell his policy to a purchaser in some scenario. There are a variety of scenarios. I'd like to make some corrections for the record. First of all, it is our best sizing estimate that the industry is today approximately $2 billion annually and growing. It's a huge national industry. It is a very small industry in this state, unfortunately, because in my view, the people who would engage in the business in this state have not found the regulation as it currently stands friendly to or allowing them to do business, which will allow them to make a profit. So it is our concern that the industry here grow as it has in many other states. I'd also like to point out that it is my understanding that there are four states in which state legislators have determined that the investment side, the purchaser side of this transaction, should be regulated under the Securities Department's. Those are North and South Dakota, North Dakota has had a biotical settlement law in the books for about 10 years and has never allowed a single biotical settlement provider to do business in the state. So it's not a very good exemplar of how we ought to go in this direction if we believe that biotical settlements are an option that ought to be available for the insured. South Dakota and Iowa have never passed regulation protecting the insured individual, the viator. Maine has an extensive record of heavy regulation in this area, which has resulted in essentially no businesses being registered to do business up there. One of the two companies registered in Oregon to do business, licensed, and there are only two, is licensed in Maine, but that company has not purchased viatical settlements for the last 6 months, but has been purchasing what we call life settlements, the policies of healthy persons who feel they have excess life coverage and want to sell it. To my knowledge, there is an agreement, my personal knowledge, there is an agreement in Florida that the Securities Department will not regulate viatical settlement. The Insurance Department has decided and has promoted legislation which just passed in Florida to regulate the purchaser's side of the viatical settlement transaction, because the department in Florida believes, as we do, that this is a seamless fabric and that a policy, which is an insurance product, traveling through this process is best understood by insurance regulators in the insurance department, not split off halfway through the process. The policy suddenly becomes a securities product. Nobody yet in any state, and some securities regulators in other states have determined that they want to regulate it, has figured out how the process is going to work, because securities typically demand filings. These are individual policies traveling as independent entities through a process, and whatever methodology is used to raise money doesn't look like a security in any certain situation, and certainly can't be filed as a security. How do you bundle a person with another person in a securities offering? It gets to be very difficult. We think that the objectives of your legislation should be to allow a terminally ill individual to sell his policy if he wishes to. We believe that healthy persons who find that they have excess insurance coverage should be able to sell their policy. We believe Oregon purchasers and investors with money to put into these policies should be able to buy such policies. We believe that two Oregon purchasers ought to be able to get together and buy a single policy, which under this proposal would become a security immediately and create great problems for them. We believe that Oregon purchasers should be able to purchase policies from the residents of other states if they choose to do so in their investment understanding. And we believe that Oregon sellers should be able to sell to a broad national market, which is not really going on today. So we believe that this whole issue needs an extensive review and extensive rethinking along the lines of what the NAIC is currently doing. Yesterday I was in Chicago for an all-day meeting, which is why I'm not too coherent this morning, of the NAIC and the American, an NAIC-sponsored meeting of what we call our technical review group, containing members of the American Council of Life Insurance, the National Association of Life Underwriters, and other interested parties who are trying to thread through the issues associated with this big emerging industry, and we are hopeful that you will adopt either the amendment as we have suggested it, or will decide that it is appropriate for this body, for this legislature, to give the national scheme time to emerge. We believe the national scheme will emerge over the next few months. There is a meeting of the NAIC next month, and at that time they will be taking up the various documents that we gave you in our package. These are consumer-oriented brochures that explain what's going on in this industry. Understanding viatical settlements is about the sale of a life insurance policy. the text of, and that has been formatted by the NAIC Publications Department into a kind of a trifold brochure if you fold up the document that's in front of you. The other two documents, Understanding Life Settlements in Oregon are viatical settlements, but in Oregon, life settlements are viatical settlements. But in the national scheme, life settlements are the sales of policies by healthy persons. And finally, the NAIC is working, and this most refers to this bill, in a document called Purchasing Viatical Settlements, a brochure to inform consumers quickly and immediately about the issues that might come on the purchasing side. The suggestion that we have given you on page 10 in sections 3 and 4 contains extensive disclosures to purchasers. This is the area in which the earlier testimony would have most been affected. If the lady who was here before me had extensive disclosure requirements, which can be mandated by the insurance department under this scheme, she would have had the information necessary to make a determination about the appropriateness of her purchase. We hope that you'll take up this comprehensive approach to looking at this industry, which is a big one, which is much too small, which should be more available to Oregon residents, and we hope that you'll consider doing this in the next session of the legislature or passing this amendment.
Thank you very much. Now, the way I understand your testimony, it seems that if we want viatical settlements to be successful in Oregon for investors, we either need to do the Dash 2 amendments or do nothing if we want to basically keep Oregon as a non-player in the viatical business. We pass the original bill. That will sum up your testimony.
And unfortunately, Oregon is a non-player today. And the residents of Oregon, I believe, suffer from that.
Just a couple of questions. One, if you have such strong objections to the bill, how come there wasn't obviously any testimony in the Senate when it's got a unanimous vote out of the Senate?
We're dealing this year. I would say that I have become a professional firefighter. I have been before a number of legislatures this year to speak on these subjects as various issues have emerged. We had no idea when this bill began that it really had what we call legs, that it was going to get up and travel. And in allocating our resources, we were unaware of what the bill did. We just weren't paying enough attention to what was going on in the Oregon market. As I mentioned earlier, there are only two licensed providers in Oregon. California has 30, Florida has 30, Texas has 40. But with those two licensed providers, neither of them funds their purchases through personal investments, and neither of them raised this issue immediately with us. So I
might add, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that in spite of that, or notwithstanding that oversight, that I have spent time with Senator Nelson, the chairman of the Senate Business Committee, that I came from, briefing him on our issues with the bill and putting him in the loop, so to speak. On that.
We regret we're late.
Okay. And just one other question within your testimony. I heard you say that the elements you felt should be included in a bill was that a healthy person should be able to sell their life insurance policy should they find they have excess insurance. Is that right?
One of the biggest areas of growth, Viaticus, which is one of the major companies in the industry, which is licensed in Oregon, has essentially gone out of the business of purchasing the policies of terminally ill individuals. They have decided that there are a great many policies out there, policies held by very high net worth individuals who have, for example, key man coverage from their corporations, and upon retirement find they're holding a policy on which the premiums are $300,000 a year for $10 million of coverage, and they're able to sell that policy. And Viaticus has gone exclusively into that business.
How many states allow that?
Today, all states allow that.
Mm, I don't think that's correct. I don't think Oregon allows the selling of healthy people's life insurance. At least last session.
Well, Oregon has a price floor that says that if you have 50%, that you have to pay 50% of the face value of the policy. If the key man with the $10 million policy and the $300,000 premiums is not able to sell his policy, it lapses in many cases. But there's a market there, and that individual may want to realize the value that's inherent in his policy. In Oregon, it doesn't sell because of that 50% requirement. And frequently, the policy, a $10 million policy, might sell for $2 million. And then somebody else is picking up the premium payment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have maybe a slight disagreement and probably a major agreement. First of all, I've never been a big fan of this. I was here when we started again this, made it through the legislature. And the reason I'm not a fan of it is because I think it takes an extreme amount of regulation. So we have protection. So there I agree with you, and I think that's the real protection that we're going to have, is make sure that if this is legal to do, that we have, in my opinion, the insurance industry regulating this on the front end, so that, because it does become a seamless situation, and you know, it's sort of rolling the, you know, it's a crapshoot a little bit of when somebody's going to die, and that's the bottom line. And so I think that I personally am not comfortable moving forward with another step at this point. I'd rather try to put more effort into the front end of this and make sure that we, I mean, this is too bad. This thing's been defrauded, but the real issue is we have to start from the start.
Okay. Are there any other states that have done the Dash 2, or are they looking at that or something similar to this besides the national group? Is there states doing that?
We believe that New Jersey and Pennsylvania will both move forward on this concept this year in their legislature. There are two other big states which have not at all regulated biadical settlements. They can see the structure hanging together into a coherent package that they're now, I believe, prepared to move on forward. And Florida has done so this year, has effectively adopted this scheme. Florida, I should point out that Florida did not adopt regulation of the life settlement, the healthy person's portion of this proposal. We wanted them to adopt it because we think it's a total package here. But the total package needs another few months of work, and it certainly needs a lot of education for insurance regulators to feel comfortable that they know all the points on which they're doing it, and so that this option is available for Oregon citizens.
New Jersey and what was the other state?
Pennsylvania.
All right.
I'm going to Massachusetts tomorrow, and we may talk to them.
Thank you very much for coming out. I appreciate you taking time.
Could I ask one last question? You know, this, I've never heard of this before, and this raises all kinds of interesting questions. And if someone is out there with a $10 million, they bought a $10 million insurance policy, and they're paying premiums, has there been any contracts put out on people's lives? Die when they're, no, that, I'm serious. That raises
it's a worthy question.
Where is it? Scary.
The fact is, no. There is no.
Not known.
There, we know
it. Where there are situations like the one you're describing, frequently they involve spouses.
Thank you very much. In the last session, we in the business committee, we dealt with adequate settlements at that point in time, and I think I have pretty much the same opinion of them as Representative Lundquist does, that you know, birth is a terminal disease, and why in Oregon have we limited it to people who only have less than 6 months to live, or 1 year? I don't remember exactly what the date is, but without those same concerns were expressed last session, about the.
I understand them.
Do you want to sell your shirts?
Mr. Chair, this is a kind of a new frontier, and I think it's Representative good representative from Springfield said, you know, this is the first few days that we've been addressing this issue, and I don't feel comfortable right now moving the original bill or moving amendments, which I just got, you know, 18 pages worth of amendments that I haven't read, and I'm not interested in moving amendments into a bill. So I would be happy to work with anybody who wants to work on this issue, so we have something firm that we can bring back either later in the session, if that, you know, if this national model should become available, or work in the interim to try to get a good bill that, you know, I can feel comfortable with, knowing what's in it and knowing what all the pieces are and who all the players are for next session.
Okay. As everyone, I think, is aware, this is probably going to be our last meeting, so our options on the bill, as I see it, are to move the original bill, move the dash two amendments into the bill, allow then it to go into then move the bill, allow the bill to go into conference committee and discuss it there and decide what we want to do with it, or see you next time. Those are kind of our options that I think we have.
Well, I think if there's some break here between now and the session, probably next is still out of committee and work on it. But barring that, I don't think in the list of the last month that it can be adequately addressed in a conference committee or in ways and means. I mean, they've got other issues going on down there, and I don't want to see this get short-shorted. So I'd assume we hold off on it. See where we're at.
Representative Thompson?
In an effort to be bipartisan, I'll support my colleague's opinion on this one.
Well, I would just wholeheartedly agree that I wouldn't feel comfortable with the amendments that come in the 11th hour. Given the realities as it looks like here, I guess the option I've laid out by saying nope would be the best.
Okay. Close the public hearing. With that, we will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1049. Open the public hearing. We have floor session at 10 o'clock, so we need to move fairly quickly on this bill. Mr. Putman.
Mr. Chairman, 1049 is a substantial rewrite of the laws governing the profession of accounting, particularly public accountants, certified public accountants, and persons who do accounting work but don't have the credentials to be either a CPA or a PA. There are conflict amendments. I've gone through them. There are conflicts with Senate Bill 152, 154, 155, and 158. And in every instance, it's my opinion, and I've talked to LC about this, that these are not substantive changes in the sense that you're simply getting the language together between this bill and these four Senate bills. All of these four Senate bills have passed the Senate and are on the floor of the House of Representatives for a vote, as near as I can tell, maybe tomorrow.
Thank you. Rob Douglas and Ray Johnson and Karen DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, here today in support of Senate Bill 1049. 1049 did pass through the Oregon State Senate with no negative votes. Everyone who had a chance to vote on it did vote yes. There were two major issues which will be discussed by Ray Johnson, the president of the CPAs, to my right. Those issues were as follows. The original bill had a provision relating to CPAs accepting commissions. I received quite a bit of attention on the Senate side, and as a result, those provisions relating to CPAs and commissions were removed from the bill. The second issue, which received attention on the Senate side, was how does this bill affect practitioners who are not CPAs? And we're prepared to address that today as well. And with that, I'd like to introduce our president, Ray Johnson.
Thank you. My name is Ray Johnson. I'm president of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a CPA. I'm also a professor at Portland State University. Senate Bill 1049 basically regulates the accounting profession. It puts us in line with regulations in a number of other states. I think the key things that are accomplished here deal with reciprocity, substantial equivalency, and non-CPA ownership. On the issue of commissions, the Oregon Society of CPAs at this point believes that Senate Bill 1049 should go forward as amended. It would keep in place the prohibitions that exist in Oregon on allowing CPAs to accept commissions. I think the other thing that's very important and that I want to express the views both of the society and my personal views on this, there's nothing in this bill that changes the regulation of non-licensees. Non-licensees would have the same rights after this bill as they would before. I'm looking right now at page 13 where it talks about the language where you regulating 13 paragraph 8. I'm looking at lines 29 to 41 of the gross version. And that subsection talks about regulating the use of accountant, auditor, or accounting by licensees. And then it goes on to say, this section does not prohibit the use of the word accountant or accounting by a person or business offering services that are not restricted to a person or business holding a license or permit to practice public accountancy. So there's nothing that we've done in this bill to change things for non-licensees.
Which lines were you on in the bill?
I apologize. Page 13, lines. It begins at line 29, the section, but the key language really begins at line 39. Line 33 says this section does not prohibit, and then when you go down to line 39, it doesn't prohibit the use of the words accountant or accounting by a person or business offering services that are not restricted to a person or business organization holding a license or permit. So, and it's really our intent here to keep the status quo for people who are non-licensees. And in fact, I think there's one benefit here for non-licensees when we move forward in the area of non-CPA ownership. I would think that we will probably see some practices emerge where CPAs might hire licensed tax consultants, and those people could be owners in the firm. I think that would be a positive benefit for both professions, licensees and non-licensees coming together. So we've tried to move forward with this in a way that doesn't change anything for the non-licensees. In the last session, we moved safe harbor language for those people into statute that stays exactly the same in statute today, and it's our intent to keep the status quo for those individuals. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions from me?
Professor, help me understand two things. On page 3 of the bill, starting at lines 15, is the safe harbor language that you referred to. That is similar to, almost identical, but not quite, the language on page 14, starting at line 25. Given the very close similarity, but not exact same wording, what is the difference between the interpretation of section 18A, page 14, and the section that starts at line 15 on page 3? I had to write an explanation to the committee, and I ignored that because I didn't know the difference.
Um, we have a representative from the Legislative Council with us.
The only difference that I can see at this point is the language on page 14, paragraph 30, actually, instead of putting date, says as of and leaves blank and allows somebody to put the potential date of the financial statements in. And in substance, they're exactly the same.
Yeah, and that's why I wondered why they were there twice. Is there a purpose there, or is that just an artifact of drafting?
I think it's an artifact of drafting, in my opinion.
A second question.
Okay.
You gave us language from, I forget what page, I think it was 13 in your testimony, lines 39, indicating that the word accountant or accounting is not restricted. And yet, if we go back to page 3, it says the statement cannot be accompanied by any wording indicating the person is an accountant.
The safe harbor language is really designed for those people who do not hold licenses. And so essentially when using the safe harbor language, essentially what you're saying is when you use that, you cannot hold yourself out as if you were a licensee. And so what is happening on paragraphs 29 through 41 is it's saying a person or business shall not assume a title that includes the word accountant, auditor, or accounting in connection with words, including that of a report that implies that a person or business organization holds a permit. And essentially what the safe harbor language has done is given people language that they can use, but the language crafted here, I think, is crafted in a way to say you can't imply that you hold a permit when, in fact, you do not.
Could you give the committee a couple of examples of instances where a person that holding no license, permit, registration, certificate, all words that are in here, none of those, someone like me, can say that I'm an accountant?
You know, I think there are a number of situations where people in business working in a variety of accounting positions say that they're accountants, a number of students that do that. I think the other group is you have a number of people who are licensed tax practitioners, and these people do accounting work, and they can say that they are accountants, that they do accounting work. Cannot hold themselves out as CPAs or PAs.
Or write a report.
Right. That's correct. And when they write a report, the report that they use is the safe harbor language.
Any other questions? Thank you. Linda, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Certainly. Members of the committee, my name is Karen DiLorenzo. I'm the administrator of the State Board of Accountancy. We do support this legislation with amendments that I believe Mr. Putman has.
Conflict amendments.
These are additional amendments besides the conflict amendments.
We only have A2 amendments.
The A2 amendments, or the ones that Mr. Rutlinger is checking on, are agreed upon by both the society and the board. They're important amendments, but not.
Yes, Mr. Douglas had gotten permission from the committee to get those amendments. I had forgotten about them. They're not here. And Mr. Rutlinger just been hoofing it down to council to try to retreat.
Okay, do you have any other testimony? Yes?
Sure. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, as I said, the board is in support of this bill with the amendments. Both before you and in the hall, and we worked very hard with the Oregon Society and interested parties, and that did include taking these proposals around the state in a series of town hall meetings last fall, where we did joint town hall meetings. They Society invited their members. We invited everyone that was not on their list that is often on ours, and then some other interest groups, including the OAIA and the LTCs and LTPs, so that everybody would be exposed and know what we were trying to do with the bill. It was always our intent, and I want to be very clear about this again, that we were very careful to maintain the allowance for non-licensees to provide the certain types of financial statements through safe harbor language, and to continue to allow non-licensed accountants to use the term accountant and accounting. What we have in Oregon works very well. We believe that through the auspices of the Board of Tax Service Examiners and the Board of Accountancy, that the public is very well protected. There's no over-regulation, and we wanted to maintain that balance between what non-licensees can do and what licensees can do, and we believe that that this bill does that, and that is certainly our intent. We don't want to make any change to services that are regulated by the Board of Accountancy, and non-licensees can still do exactly what they have always done. Oregon does need this bill to stay competitive and to allow licensees to move forward into the globalization of the accounting profession, and we are supporting this bill with all of the amendments in their various places.
Mr. Chair.
Why didn't you do this in the Senate? Why the running down the hall to get the last-minute amendments when you've been working on this for 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, this bill was not moving in the Senate with the commission provision. Once the commission provision was out, it moved in a heartbeat, and thus we did not get the Board of Accountancy amendments that we had agreed to in the bill. So we take full responsibility for that. Once they released the bill, it moved very quickly.
This bill was worked on the Senate by a work group for months. Last session, I believe a similar bill, the original bill, came forward, and the different groups came in front of my committee last session, and we asked them to go work on their differences and come back, and they had agreements, and now they're back. That was 97. So, Mr. Putnam.
Representative Morissette, Mr. Douglas did come to us as soon as he saw this was scheduled and did ask for the amendments. There's simply, the guy who wrote them went after them, so they've got to be somewhere.
Hope they're out of the computer and on paper. That was the testimony. We will stand at ease until we get the council back.
Thank you.